announcements. Normally we would be also Zooming and having in-person meetings at the Osafi Hall, but due to unforeseen circumstances, the Osafi Hall is closed today. We are still Zooming, of course, but we will be open for in-person meetings next Sunday. And if you are Zooming, we just ask that if you're going to be up moving around, to please put your video on stop. And if you're going to be, please mute yourself if you're not going to be speaking or making any comments. And we ask that all comments are directed towards the chair. And when you do come into Theosophy Hall, we just ask that you do not wear any fragrances, as we do have students that attend that are sensitive to certain fragrances. So we will start now with the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of the aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So in order for the Philadelphia ULT to accomplish these goals, we do have three meetings a week. As today, our meeting starts at 11 and goes until 12. Theosophy Hall will open at 10:30. This, we have an overall umbrella topic every month for our Sunday sessions. This month has been the mysterious mind. Last week, though, we did have a special meeting on William Q. Judge Day. Starting next month, the overall topic is the science and art of communication. And the meeting for next week will be the creative potency of sound and speech. We are on Wednesdays, we are finishing up our class on Devacon, the after death states. And this will be the second half of the chapter on Devacon. And the meeting starts at 7:30 and goes until 8:45. And our Friday meeting, which is a roundtable discussion, a little less formal than our Sunday and Wednesday meetings. And we are looking at Mr. Judge's the Heart Doctrine, and for this coming Friday, we'll be looking at HPB was not deserted. And the books for Friday and for Wednesday can be found on the Phoenix ULT website at phx-ult-lodge. .org. Got that part. So we think that's all the announcements. Oh, the quarterly periodical will be coming out this week, and that will give everybody the times the meeting starts, what classes are being looked at. So that will be sent out to everyone sometime this week. So today, the meeting is entitled The Mystery of Enduring Memory. And we will have a short forum talk and then plenty of time for questions and discussions afterwards.
The Mystery of Enduring Memory. Have you ever given any thought to how much you know? We would think that most folks probably never think about the wealth of knowledge they have on so many and diverse subjects and topics. The weather, children, philosophy, medicine, clothes, computers, phones, food, cars, nutrition, transportation, etc., etc. Most of us are actually walking, talking, thinking, and sharing many Googles. But unlike Google, with its mega networks of employees and servers and other resources to call upon, you and I, dear heart, are standalone founts of knowledge, experience, and wisdom. We all know basically how Google retrieves the information it needs for any given question or moment. But how do we do it? How do we bring something from a long ago time to a current conversation? All these questions must inevitably lead us to the somewhat intricate subject of memory. When you think of memory, know that it is just the generic name for the innate power within us, thinking beings, of reproducing past impressions. So how is this done? What triggers us to remember? Well, it's normally through an association of ideas suggested by objective things or by some action on our five external senses. For example, a special word in a poem, a scent from a bouquet, a lyric from a song, or perhaps beautiful music you heard, or maybe a glimpse of a look-alike person, or perhaps a visit from an old friend. Taking a closer look, memory is a faculty depending entirely on the normal functioning of our physical brain. Well, there are three types or forms of memory: remembrance, recollection, and reminiscence. And there are indeed differences between them all. In remembrance, we can get the idea, but not all the particulars that have brought about that feeling, event, or circumstance of the past. In recollection, we can collect back from one point all the other points connected with it. But there is a third function of the memory known as reminiscence, which most importantly is not at all dependent upon the physical brain. It is brought into function oftentimes not by any present object or occurrence arousing attention in that direction, but springs directly from the soul itself. It comes from something behind the brain serving merely as a sort of a filter, an interceptor, or translator of the impressions. It is a direct perception of what was. It is otherwise known as soul wisdom. Very few events are impressed upon us or are immediately translatable through the brain by way of remembrance. Even if we so desired and tried until our brain hurt, we could never make a complete history of all those impressions through the faculty of recollection either. Yet there is the inherent faculty of recalling, recollecting, and reassembling in such a way as to have a consecutive or synthetic grasp of all those impressions through reminiscence. That faculty of memory, which applies to the soul, a truly fascinating innate quality of the soul. This type of memory is true memory, and it is indeed possible for every living being to achieve. So with all these different facets or types of memories to draw from, how come we are not all geniuses? How come we don't remember anything about a past life? Let's take a look at the first question regarding why we are not geniuses. The widely believed and the typical response to that question is that heredity is the answer to the origin of genius. No theosophist denies that heredity does have a role in the way you look, with your mother's little turned up nose, or perhaps your father's eyes and voice. And let's not forget that heredity does give us a physical brain and body. And of course, we certainly need both to exhibit our genius and also to complete our human experience. There is no divine hand from the heavens creating geniuses. There are no accidentally created geniuses. And you didn't get your genius from your parents. The presence in man of various creative power called genius in their collection is due to no blind chance, to no innate qualities through hereditary tendencies, but to an accumulation of individual antecedent experiences of the ego in its preceding life and lives. You, dear heart, are the origin of genius. Within you is the genius. The manifestation of genius in a man or woman, as William Q. Judge said, provides an immortal ego and reincarnation. It proves, rather, an immortal ego and reincarnation in our world. The flame of genius isn't lit by an anthropomorphic God's hand, save that of our own spirit. It is the very nature of the spiritual entity itself. It is our ego, our absolute individuality, which keeps on interweaving new life experiences into our individual web of reincarnation on the loom of time. The egos of a Newton, a Tesla, or a Shakespeare are of the same essence and substance as the egos of an ignoramus, a fool, or even an idiot. No ego differs from another ego. It is primal, or original essence and nature. That which makes one mortal a great man and of another a vulgar, silly person is the quality and makeup of the physical shell or casing and the adequacy or inadequacies of brain and body to transmit and give expression to the light of the real man, the inner man. And this aptness or ineptness is in its turn the result of karma. Or to use another simile, physical man is the musical instrument and the ego, the performing artist. The potentiality of perfect melody of sound is in the former, the instrument, and no skill of the latter, the artist, can awaken a faultless harmony out of a broken or badly made instrument. This harmony depends on the fidelity of transmission by word or act to the objective plane. Physical man may, to follow our simile, be a priceless Stradivarius, or a cheap and cracked fiddle, or again, a mediocrity between the two. Genius is living proof of the pre-existence of a spiritual thread soul. The power of the soul's innumerable life experiences, focused like the sun through a magnifying glass, greatly increases its force. Every time, in every rebirth, we get reconnected to our very own self-constructed, pre-existing, personal, and collective karmic web. The lessons of this web are our ongoing opportunities, steps leading to our growing self-awareness and enlightenment. It is the very nature of the spiritual entity itself that asserts itself stronger than in the average man through its personality, so that what we call the manifestations of genius in a person are only the more or less successful efforts of that ego to assert itself on the outward plane of its objective form, the man of clay in the matter-of-fact daily life of the latter. The second question was about why we don't remember past lives. The memory of walking is with us now. The memory of talking is with us now. We may not remember how nor when we learned to walk or talk, but we have present with us the knowing of how to walk and talk. True memory is just that, the possession of that knowledge of the past, not only on the physical plane, however. Dreams attest that we are alive and active on inner planes, for in them we think, we speak, we smell, we taste, we hear, and we move as individuals and never have any question as to our identity, even though the personality presented should be that of some past incarnation. The dreaming state is very close to the point of waking, the intermediate state between waking and sleep, so that we are able to impress the brain cells with what has occurred before waking and remember. But beyond the dreaming stage, which is a short stage of sleep, there is a vast extent of human thought and action. We go in and in until we are close to the source of our own being, where the thinker is at work, where he knows all that he has been through all his past incarnations, where he sees and knows himself as he is. The memory of all the experiences through which he has been as an individual being is there in one consecutive whole. True memory is the paradise which all human beings should strive to regain. To recover that whole memory, to make that great knowledge of the past usable here and now in the brain and in the body, is the true work of salvation. The barrier for us is not in the memory, but in the false ideas of life according to which we act. However much the soul remembers, if we are using the brain contrary to the nature of the soul, the brain will not and cannot translate its impressions. The thinker must transfer the memory of the soul to the brain, and he can do so only by thinking and acting along right lines during active waking consciousness until the brain responds to those ideas and learns to transmit what occurs while the body is inoperative. Then the true memory of the past, that is in the soul, will become our knowledge in the brain. So in case you have forgot, topic for today's consideration is the mystery of enduring memory.
Thank you. So again, the title for today's class is The Mystery of Enduring Memory. And it had been asked to us recently, the mystery, why is it such a mystery? I mean, you remember something, you forget it. Why is this such a mystery? Memory just is. But when we're looking at this idea of the mystery of enduring memory, it is a mystery then. Enduring meaning not just this, you know, this moment here, we will remember this. And, you know, tomorrow we will remember being here. But the last part of the talk was putting forth the idea of why we don't remember past lives. So in that case, there is a mystery because we don't remember what those past lives are. We don't know how we gained, if we're very proficient in something, not even necessarily a genius in it, but we're very good at a particular action. You know, how did we get that? Where did those memories come? Because theosophy puts forth this idea that indeed we do bring these talents and thoughts from past lives forward. So that is the mystery of how does all this work? And it's a very involved, it's a very complicated topic. So let's see with questions and discussions today if we can kind of scratch that surface. SL?
Well, to begin with, we thought it would be interesting to bring to our awareness other phenomena we're all familiar with, which convince us of the mystery. One is that children, in fact, do remember their past lives. And for example, at the University of Virginia Department of Psychiatry for decades now, they've been collating the stories of children who remember their past lives and been able to prove that these details are accurate. Under hypnosis, people not only remember the details that they've forgotten from the earliest moments of their lives in this life, but also seem to be remember past lives. Psychics and mediums seem to be able to have access to memories that we've forgotten. And in our dreams, sometimes we do remember places that we've been and people we've met, even in this life, that we've completely forgot about. Closer to home, things like intuition, conscience, all these are indicators of previous experience, but we cannot find any mechanism in the brain or the body to account for how these impressions endure. It has to go beyond. So yes, it's a complex subject and it invites study in all the different parts of our nature, but we do have to realize how mysterious it is.
Yes, you know, as was just given, there are many examples of how people do in different ways, how people do remember certain aspects of the current life and the past life. So what is it then that is the impactor of whether we're going to remember certain things? And the talk brought out the idea that the way we think and act can impact the brain. And we know that there are many examples of people who, and this is what's very interesting, is that there are people who may be differently, they may be disabled in certain respect and may not have the mental capacity to act in a normal life, say with, you know, they have issues with spelling or speaking, that type of thing. Yet you give them a date and they can remember what has happened on that date years and years and years before. There are people that are able to read a telephone book and they can tell you what a person's name, where they lived, you know, their address, all sorts of things. So in many respects, the brain does not have to be perfect in order to bring forth these ideas, these memories of this life or a past life. So it's just the brain is a very complex organ, and we certainly do not know everything about it, but it seems to be the conduit between memory and the expression of it. JCS?
I read in the philosophy that one of our duties of life is to make the brain more porous. How are we to understand that in terms of retrieving enduring memories or to strengthen that power within us?
Well, when the philosophy talks about making the brain more porous to the dictates of the soul, it's making it so that what that higher nature wants to tell us and influence us, that when we're making it porous, we need to try and detach ourselves from the distractions of the day. We need to put into our brain, into our mind, we need to put in high ideals and not some of the lower that we see on TV, in the movies, and some books that maybe are very violent in nature. So to make it porous to the dictates of the soul, to put in higher thoughts, meditate, read the philosophy, read the devotional books, come to meetings, study. So there are a lot of different ways that we can make porous to the dictates of the soul. And in that way, these higher memories, the true memory, will be able to express itself if our brains are high, you know, if they've been impressed by the soul. SL?
So when we are incarnated, the brain is the vehicle that the lower mind or lower manas works through. They're very much connected. So making the brain more porous or receptive or plastic to the soul's memories involves the way we control our thoughts, the kinds of thoughts we control in our waking state. And even science now recognizes the neuroplasticity of the brain itself, how its very structure and function changes under the influence of the thoughts. But we were thinking also, because HBB mentions in several places that the heart is the vehicle of buddhi manas, or our higher mind, our soul memories, don't we also have to make our hearts permeable or open to the dictates of the soul? So it would seem that it involves much more than working with our mind, but with our hearts as well.
So when we talk about making our heart more permeable, that's an interesting thought, because we're thinking of the emotional aspect that we can be looking at. The heart is not just an organ, although it, of course, it is an extremely important organ. And because it affects our entire body and our brain, we need to treat it well, take care of it, and at the same time, there's that emotional and spiritual aspect to the heart that we all think about. It's, you know, when something happens, if someone dies, somebody might say, "My heart is breaking." Well, we know their heart itself is not breaking, although it may feel that way if we have lost someone that we have loved dearly. So there's that emotional and psychic aspect to the heart. And indeed, it is, because there is that connection with buddhi manas and our intuition along with that, and the true memory. It is important that we do also make that psychic aspect of the heart more porous to the soul as well. Any other comments on that, or go on to a different idea? Yes, SL.
So one of the phenomena that we've read about for so many years in various sources is this idea that people will tell them either when they think they're going to die, or in the philosophy of the moment, that their entire life flashes before their eyes. Down to the very details, they seem to be remembering things that they completely forgot. And then within the past month, there have been some scientific articles where an individual in the middle of a MRI scan passed away, and they were able to continue to do an MRI scan of the brain when the person was clinically dead, and they saw that those areas of the brain connected with memory became much more active. So it seemed to confirm this age-old experience. So if that's the case, there must be a recording nature, or recording principle in nature in ourselves, which is beyond the physical. With astral brain or astral body or astral light, something that retains the impressions of everything we go through. And so the brain is just one way in which it can come through, but it can also be accessed apparently by our psychic senses or the psychic senses of another human being.
So our understanding that everything is recorded in the astral, and depending upon if it's a higher nature or a lower nature will depend. I mean, the astral does have seven planes, so to speak. And we know that the Akasha is the highest, and then the lowest, which is said to have the dregs of everything that people think that is negative in a way. So everything is stored in the astral, and our thinking, and we can certainly put this out for additional thoughts, is that during this period when somebody, especially drowning victims, say that their life, and of course the drowning victims that they've been able to revive, that they said that their lives flashed before them. And we wonder if there's some mechanism where there is a need for these, the life to flash forward, to flash in front of them. And we know that when a person dies, there is that review. And the review is everything, you know, in minute detail, from the time that they were born until the time they died. But that is only for this current life. And we know that some of the memories people experience are from past lives, but everything is stored in the astral. So we think that there is a mechanism where people are able to access those memories. So if anybody wants to add to that. JCS.
Well, it's an interesting dilemma, a mysterious dilemma to try to put that into words, isn't it? Because we don't want to say the astral is layered, because it's not a location. And it's not external or physiological purely. So how would the philosophy talk about the oneness when discussing memory impacted within the physical, memory impacted within the astral, memory impressed within true heart and soul? It's not here or there, is it?
So we're looking then at a very complicated situation, as was just said. We have the true memory, which is from soul, and we have remembrance and recollection, which is from the lower mind, and we have the brain and the heart, which are physical, that get involved with this whole thing as well. So indeed, there must be something that like coordinates all of this together. And we just, you know, trying to think about that is to wrap your mind around all these different aspects of what is the major player in this whole thing. And would it be the heart? Because it is said that if somebody is looking at a more negative way of life, that they are not going to be able to access true memory, because the brain needs to be functioning at an optimum positive spiritual level in order to access that. And so, and then if it is acting at, if the heart, the psychic aspect of the heart is working from the lower, then the only thing that's going to be expressed are those two lower types of memory, the remembrance and recollection. So we're wondering then if the spiritual heart is the one idea that could be tying all of this together. That love and compassion that we speak about. Maybe it is that spiritual heart. Now, we have just been trying to talk this through now. So if there are any additional ideas in regards to that, we'd like to hear them. SL?
Well, one of the ideas we see over and over again in the philosophy, whether it's referring to the universe or our Earth or ourselves as individuals, is that things can exist in the same space but be of a different degree of substance. And therefore, each degree of that substance is capable of being impressed and having a memory of its own. So, for example, with the physical body, we've already talked about the memory of the heart, the memory of the brain and the nervous system. But we know we have a common expression of muscle memory. You train the muscles in a certain way, they act automatically. We have physical habits that affects our digestive system so that it remembers certain things to do. Even the blood has a memory of our own. So even, and all these things are at different degrees of substance, and yet they all combine to make what we call the memory of our body. So we think that's a useful idea, that the unity is that there's one primordial degree of substance from which all different degrees have come from, and so this whole universe is of the same essence, spiritually and materially, just different degrees of that. Just like the white light can be broken up into the different degrees of the different colors of light, so forth. So that white light is the unity from which everything has come. Yeah.
In regards to muscle memory, those of us who have played instruments and all the practice that we went through when we were first learning it, and eventually knowing where to put your fingers for the notes, just became what they say second nature. But if we ever stop to really think about where to put our fingers for certain notes, we kind of got all confused and didn't get it right. So this is a perfect example of, that muscle memory. And in regards to the human form, and one of the interesting, we just recently became aware of a fiddle player who is blind and is almost totally deaf, yet he is considered to be one of the best fiddle players in the country ever. And when we think about how he was able to hear, even though he was almost deaf, let alone know where to put his fingers, we can look at this idea of genius bringing forth, because this gentleman has been playing at a top-notch level since maybe 5. So when we think of genius and these memories coming through all these lives and impacting him now, where he doesn't even need to be able to see the instrument that he's playing, and feeling the vibrations in the strings and in the wood, kind of going together with what is left of his hearing, it's just an incredible, it's incredible to watch what this gentleman is able to do with his limitations. So we think with this idea of genius and the memories that have come through and have impacted different levels, different parts of his body, and have all come together to be able to play like this, is a perfect example, we think, of muscle memory, of genius being, you know, when we talk about reincarnation, it certainly is a proof to us that this is a proof of reincarnation coming through. MDW.
There's a very curious statement in the Voice of the Silence on this subject. It simply states, kill in thyself all memory of past experience. Look not behind, or thou art lost. How does that reconcile with this conversation this morning?
We wonder if when it says kill out all memories of the past, we wonder if it's actually speaking of an attachment to those memories. That we are not obsessed with what has happened in the past. So that is the only thing that we can think of, is that it's an attachment to those memories, but not to let them rule our lives. SL?
Well, aside from the attachment we have, the coming forth of memory, Mr. Judge describes as one of the natural activities of the lower mind, the bringing forth of the memory, especially of that which is unpleasant, traumatic experiences, just unpleasant experiences. And how often the memory of not just the bad times, but the good times, the cherished times that we've had with individuals, when we think about them or grieve about them because we feel that we will never have them again, we are, with those memories of the past, for the time being, overwhelmed with sadness, grief, depression, misery, anxiety. And for that moment, our minds are lost in it, attached to it, lost to it. And we forget we forget to be in the now, and we forget of who we are and who they are as immortal spiritual beings, and that there is no separateness. So it doesn't mean we have to forget the value of what we went through, the lessons, but as you said, the emotional attachments of that come up through memory. Love is a great source of misery in that sense, when we are very much attached to the experiences of our past.
And we think, in regards to folks who suffer from PTSD, we often wonder, I mean, those memories are so impressed into their minds, and the littlest thing, you know, a sound can bring back those awful memories. And as was just said, and hopefully love and compassion from others can help soothe some of those. And we just wonder what is going on in their memory when something this extreme imprints so dramatically on their minds. And we're guessing at the lower mind, and we know that true memory cannot function if the brain is being impacted by some of these lower memories and feelings. So it's a very involved concept here with PTSD. SL.
In line with that, we're taught that love and hate make the most enduring impressions, not only in our lower nature, but in our minds as well. This is why when souls incarnate, they can feel an immediate repulsion or attraction to individuals and conditions that they've never met in this life, because they retain in their natures the enduring love and hate or love or hate impressions.
Yes, we know what the stand is. Things are imprinted in them, and we pick them up when we reincarnate, and they have enduring impact on us, and we make new ones as life goes on that will come back in future lives. So, you know, we can't get away from any of this. It's there, and we have to learn how to deal with these things that come back to us. And we understand with people that have past life memories that some of them may be very loving and compassionate, and others may be more of a fearful nature. But, you know, we are bringing them forward, and to get rid of them, we have to look at them. And we don't have to, like we were discussing with the Voice of the Silence quote, we don't have to like these impressions that are there, but accepting them so that we don't get focused on them, which can impact all of our future decisions. JCS.
One of the most enduring memories that we take for granted, which is just so automatic, is the notion of I am. You know, regardless of aging across years, regardless of brain injury creating amnesia or temporary amnesia, regardless of waking, dreaming, or sleeping state, that enduring memory of the true nature of self comes through, and we take it for granted. We don't even consider it usually in our daily lives.
No, that's true.
And there's a chat.
Yes, we thank you. That's true about that sense of I, because that is us, and it's just a natural course of things that we know that I is I. And we say, I am. I am happy. I am sad. But it is not the I that is happy or sad. It's basically an expression of what is going on with us, probably in our lower thoughts and feelings, which kind of goes along with the chat that came in. In the state of Devakan, do we get impressions from our lower mind? By the time the soul has gotten into Devakan, it has sloughed off the lower tendencies in Kamaloka, so that whatever is going into Devakan is of a higher, more pure nature. It's the higher aspirations that we have not been able to fulfill in the present life. So the lower mind, although in life it has impressed the higher mind, by the time the soul gets to Devakan, those lower thoughts and feelings and actions have been sloughed off in Kamaloka. Um, So it's interesting, we had written down some questions that we wanted to ask, but lo and behold, we've answered them. So the whole idea, we did want to maybe go into a little bit more, we have a few minutes left, in regards to this idea of comparing egos to geniuses, or as it says in one of the readings, fools. And sometimes it's hard to understand that we are all of the same nature. When we see that these geniuses who are able to bring forward all these magnificent memories and compare them with somebody who really doesn't care about like music or reading higher things. Sometimes it's hard to understand that in their essence, they are both the same. But the memories that are brought forward, we think are what makes these people different from each other. And we know also that heredity may be giving the fool a different brain than somebody who is a genius. So there's a lot of different aspects to this, SL.
Well, besides geniuses and fools being the same in essence, differing only according to acquired nature, isn't it also true that what we call saints and sinners, or we who judge to be saints and sinners, are of the same essence, in the same nature, and only differ according to the acquired mental, psychic, moral, emotional, intellectual nature they have received in this life under karma. So that person we judge to be a saint or saintly in this life under different conditions in the future may not appear so, and vice versa with those persons we judge to be inadequate or sinners or full of imperfections.
So we never know that person who we're sitting next to on the bus. You know, they just seem to be very sad, maybe down and out on their luck. Maybe in a past life, they were rich and famous, but, you know, for whatever reason, karma gave them a different hand in this life, different lessons that they had to learn now that they didn't learn in a previous life. So that too, you know, we never know who we're sitting next to. And there is that, we all know it was mentioned about different, you know, we walk into a room and there is someone there that we know that we have known before. And then there's those that we just don't even want to get near. So we have a few minutes left if anybody wants to bring anything else up. So we do want to just remind everybody not to forget that there's memories that we can cultivate. Sometimes there are these wonderful memories of we got a chat. Let's check that one in. Can we make ourselves a genius? How do we go about it? How do we start in our present incarnation? Well, we wonder about making the mind porous, and how that will, depending upon how we live our present life, we don't know about making ourselves a genius in this lifetime, but we can certainly open up our minds and hearts to higher thinking, higher living, higher acting, so that all of these things can impact our lower mind, so it can rise up to a higher level. And then by focusing more on that higher mind, we can bring this true memory more into our daily life. So just want to thank everybody, and please remember our ocean class on Wednesday. Thank you.